Greetings, nerds. This is Cena Nerd. I'm your host, Sarah Belmont, and with me, as always, is our Mr. Producer, Will Polk. How are you doing tonight, Will?
Doing very well, Sarah. How are you doing this evening?
Well, you've already managed to surprise me, because during pre-show talk, when we normally do not talk about what we're going to talk about, you spilled some tea, and so now I'm just like, interesting.
Yeah. Maybe, no, but I could have been doing a head fake, too, you know.
Oh well, I think I've talked to you long enough to know when you're pulling a head fake. You know, there's some tells. I hear your voice on a regular basis.
True. Yeah, after 7 years of doing this, we kind of know. Yeah, there are some things where, if we were to play a game of poker, it would be hard to bluff one another.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. Talking about bluffing and playing poker, House of Dragon dropped a trailer. Actually, it was two, because there was the green side trailer and the black side trailer, which wasn't, nobody was expecting that, right? Everyone kept saying the trailer is coming. So when I looked, I'm like, oh, there's two of them.
Yeah.
Now, I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. However, I think the tagline "all must choose" is stupid. And here's why. Who the heck is on Team Green?
I need
to know a fan that watched the first season that is legitimately on like Team Green. And yes, I get it. We got some incest happening on Team Black. But if you're on Team Green, then I need to understand you. And in my opinion, that means you did not like Viserys at all. And if that is the case, then why are you watching the show?
Amen. Yeah, seriously, though, if anybody is on Team Green, please, you know, on our socials, if you listen to us on YouTube, drop a comment
or make
the case for Team Green, because to your point about the trailers, just brilliant marketing, just effing brilliant. As far as just, I agree with you that the tagline is, you know, a little like, okay, we got, you know, hyping it up. It was smart. You know, they dropped the posters and stuff yesterday, and to set the stage. I know we had the little teaser trailer back late last year, but the two trailers, and we got the release date too, which is June 16th. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it really set, really, well, as I was watching the trailers again the night before we were recording, it really just like, oh yeah, it just does a great job of just framing the conflict between the two, and like the Team Green trailer, just remembering how, speaking of Viserys and Alicent, like, hearing what she wanted to hear whenever he said Aegon.
Right.
And then of course on the Team Black, just Rhaenyra and Daemon, and just, you know, I can't wait for June. I'm just like, this is one of those series. I didn't watch Game of Thrones, so I was new to the universe and the franchise, and I'm 100% on board with the show. I don't think it's on disappoint at all. I mean,
so I'm going to be honest, besides my thoughts about the tagline being a bit lame, I honestly watched both of them. Mm-hmm. I didn't like it. I felt like they told me, and I get it, they're trying to attract viewers who may not have watched the first season. Okay, whatever. But to me, I appreciate the first season trailers a lot more. There was just something about it where it felt, I don't know, there was not enough tension for me. And there was a lot more fights and a lot more action sequences. And then when Team Green, like, we get a few clips from them talking about like Alicent's point of view and everything, I'm just like, yeah. Olivia Cook, where are you? You did great in season one. I don't know. This isn't hitting the way I want it to. Mm. So So I'm still obsessed with this show. Don't get me wrong. I didn't need to watch the trailers to want to see this the second season, by all means. But I honestly, when I compare it to other trailers of things, I was a bit disappointed.
I can see that. I can see your point. And I think, you know, maybe it's where we're coming from as far as, you know, you're been in this longer than I have as far as Game of Thrones stuff. So, I mean, and I'm not saying that to mean that you're like having the carryover effect that many fans had the way that that series ended.
No.
More of, I just know you as far as how you react to things and trailers and stuff. It just sounds like this just reinforces things that you already know.
Right. Yeah. I guess where I can really articulate that where my disappointment stems from is there was no scene or no part of either trailer where I was like, oh, I can't wait to see that. I can't wait to understand the context of this, because I'm just like, okay. But at the same time, Will, like, that all I can hope for is that means they're holding things back.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, like, beggars can't be choosers. I'm fine. As long as they held back the right things, I am perfectly fine. I think I just want to make sure, from my perspective, there's nothing wrong for me saying, like, this trailer disappointed me. It has nothing to do with the show itself.
Right.
Like, it's advertisement for that show, but I'm not going to hold it against it, because I'm not going to watch these trailers between now and when I actually sit down and watch the show. So I'm not going to, like, hold on to, like, oh, they showed that in the trailer. No.
Yeah.
So... Yeah. Speaking about, like, mixed review trailers, we got a few of them this week, but Star Wars Acolyte trailer came out, and before it came out, it also dropped the poster. Yeah. Now, Will, please explain to me, how can the poster be so much cooler than the trailer?
Yeah.
Did the person who designed the poster watch the trailer?
I don't think so. Because, this was one, like House of the Dragon, this is one of those trailers. I knew the show. We finally did get confirmation that as far as the release date, prior to the trailer and the poster, which is June 4. I mean, we knew it was coming in June, but I think, but anyway... When I saw that poster and the lightsaber smeared with blood, I was just like, all what they've been saying about this show going in a different direction, we're going back to the High Republic. It is set 100 years before Phantom Menace. It was supposed to be a thriller, mystery, you know, darker take on things. That poster, I was like, oh yeah, it got me hyped. When I saw the trailer, it was okay, but I just felt like I felt like it was just a remix of what I've seen before. And especially when I watched it again tonight before, you know, I had the initial reaction. I was like, okay, this is cool. But watching it again, and I was just really watching it from a critical eye, I was like, this just feels like it's just a rehash of stuff that we've seen before. Yes, there's a Sith. Yes, it's the High Republic. They're new people. But it just, like, all right, I feel like I'm in the Skywalker saga again.
Oh, right. It's because what Star Wars has been doing with their universe is they've been, instead of, like, chronological order, there's, like, different points of time and things are separated, and yet they even play into this idea, during this time the Sith were in charge. During this time, it was the Jedi. And then here's the story of how it flipped. And here's the story how it flipped back and back. And you're just like, I don't care if this is 100 years before. You're telling me the same story.
Yeah.
Essentially. Yeah. Now, they also, they could have done it a lot more. They could have been more creative with it, because from my, I also understood this like almost to be like the origin story of the dark side. Yeah. And really where it came from and how it disrupted everything and caused this battle that has now gone on for years. Mm-hmm. But they didn't sell it that way. They sold it more as like, okay, so is this another, it's just feels like more of the same. And yes, I always argue there, Star Wars, for whatever reason, I've been in fatigue mode for a while now with their shows. Mm-hmm. I am, the one thing that got me though is the main actress in it. I want to say her name is Amanda something.
Amanda, that's Stanfield.
Yeah, Stanfield. Yeah. She's a pretty good actress. I've seen her in a few things. So I'm curious to see her, and I'm especially now that it's like she's gonna be the dark side person. I was like, oh, that's interesting. But you didn't really hear her say anything. And so
I'm
like, which is, again, more of the same. I'm so tired of the dark side being so quiet. And I'm just like, no, you need more talkers.
Need more talkers. I mean, I know, you know, it would, like Carrie Ann Moss showing up. I mean, I couldn't help but like thinking of Trinity. I mean, it's just like,
oh, absolutely.
I mean, it was that. I mean, it didn't do anything. It was just like she's playing the same type of character, and it's just like, and, you know, go against type, or something. But you know, the fights seem very like still what we saw in like Obi, like in Ahsoka, when they had like a lot of those dark scenes, you know, where those lightsaber battles were underwhelming in many cases. So, and also we learned the runtime for these shows, and it's 8 episodes, 30, 35 minutes. So if you're going to do it that short, and because we've seen enough of the Star Wars shows now to.
Wasn't that like Ahsoka?
Yeah. They just make a movie.
Yep.
At this point.
Yep. I think this show is going to get very similar criticism that Ahsoka got. Mm-hmm. Especially now that I understand the run times are pretty much the same. And
Yeah, I think there's one. I think she's the showrunner said she said maybe went 40 minutes. But you know, that's just when you know a short runtime like that, but you know, when things really are just really getting going in a story, it fades to black, and I'm just like, it just makes it really, really hard. When I saw the poster, I was super hyped, because I was like, oh, something fresh, something new.
Yeah.
Post trailer, I'm kind of on the fence. I'm just going to hold judgment and see where it goes.
I'll judge it.
At least I didn't see a bunch of sand. I thought about you.
I know. It's interesting as we talk about a universe that seems to just be on the downward trend and can't figure out a way to reinvent itself. We're going to switch over and talk about the Spider-Verse, which continues to expand, and viewers have yet to get tired of. Well, it's been announced that the Spider-Verse animated short called The Spider Within a Spider Within is set to debut on YouTube on March 26th. The short will focus on Miles having a panic attack while dealing with the pressures of being a teenager, student, and protecting the city. The short shares how Miles reaches out to get help for his mental health challenges.
Yeah. So, I saw this today, and It it's a Spider-Verse, the Spider Within, the Spider-Verse stories, the title, and it's a project that actually the Kevin Love Foundation fund is partnering with Sony to do this. And Kevin Love, for folks who follow NBA basketball, are probably very familiar with this story. He's a phenomenal player, but he's also been very open about his mental health challenges. And he is one of the backers of this project. And they're also even going to do a companion piece with it to help, a curriculum that, could be there for teenagers and other folks that will, give people opportunity to really open up, show coping mechanisms. Apparently, I think they're going to do like a creative storyboard, so that's interactive, so you can use it. And one of the things Kevin Love mentioned that we'll see in the series is Miles, as he's dealing with this panic attack and opening up to his father and showing how whenever we do have our mental health challenges on things, not to clam up and keep it all inside. So it sounds like it's going to be a mix of both entertainment, but also going to be helpful, which I think is great. So I can't wait to see this on YouTube next week.
Yeah, I like how they're not just doing it to keep Spider-Verse on everyone's mind, but there's a message beneath it.
Yeah.
So I can really appreciate that. And it's a good use of platform and to provide content. So put that on your calendars, people. We will probably be talking about it in the future. All right. So let's just get Invincible out of the way because Will doesn't want to talk about it.
I do. It's not that I don't want to talk about it. It's not that I don't want to talk about it. It's just
he doesn't want to continue talking about it.
It's just, we're going to start. We're looking at Three Body Problem as well coming up. Drops tomorrow, right? Yeah, it's already here.
Oh, it's already on Netflix.
Oh, it's already on? Okay. Yeah. So I was just trying to figure out which way to go, folks. So.
You're right. So we did watch Invincible Season 2, Episode 5, This Must Come as a Shock, which is the first episode to drop of the second half of the second season. So I watched this on Sunday, and I will be honest, I actually was pretty engaged because they did a pretty good job of reminding me things that happened during the fourth episode, as well as starting to talk about where could these characters potentially go from there. I can appreciate that Mark had to take home his baby brother.
Yep.
To then become a single father now. Basically. much to Cecil's dismay. But then it lost me during the third act fight sequences that were going on, and anything to do with, I want to say, the Guardian stuff. I have not followed that storyline at all, so I never have any investment in it. But overall, I was just like, okay, I'm here for it. We'll just wrap it up. But during our pre-show discussion, we'll raise some points, and it does sound like next week we'll be starting Three Body, One Problem, and we may or may not ever finish Season 2 of Invincible.
Stick with us, folks, though. Don't while we talk about Episode 5, though, because maybe, I agree with you. I did like the return of the show. It was both the season premiere as well as the mid-season return both had Mark jacked up, getting beat up, from his father, and then again with the Viltrumites, at the end of the first half of the second season. But I like the way that they turned the narrative this time around, and instead of Mark being, you know, beat down, and this, you know, how he responded after the what happened at the end of the season. Now, like, as you noted, you know, he's on Thraxon and learning about his brother, half-brother, also, you know, helping the society rebuild. He has a purpose to the place that he actually, like, lost. He was, it ended up being like 2 months that he was there. And so it definitely, and I think Nolan, after being taken away, wanted Mark to read the books and stuff. And I think Mark started to understand where Nolan was coming from and why he is such a, you know, he goes from planet to planet, like, you know, basically siring kids. I mean, I thought it was a good, you're right. It was engaging. The stuff too, where we found out what was truly going on with Donald, I like that story, because I know we were both wondering what was going on with him in the first half of the season too. And especially, so those were all cool things I did like about it. The Guardian story, I was like you as well. I mean, these characters just don't resonate with me at all. So I think that's where some of my reticence and kind of like where I feel like the show gets uneven at times. It is just like, if it just solely focused on Mark and his and things that are going on there, it's a solid show. But the other things, and I know it's an ensemble, it just, those parts just don't.
It's never felt like an ensemble to me.
If that was the intention,
then they missed it, because they really, from the first episode, made this about Mark and Nolan.
Yeah.
And having, like, there's such a detachment between Mark and the Guardians, mm-hmm. that I don't feel like I'm watching a team show. So granted, we have Adam Eve, who, because they did that, those two episodes that were kind of part of the season, but not really. I understand her character a little bit more than I did during the first season, but they're not going to do that for every single character on the Guardians. And that's not really what you should have to do in order to understand characters part of the ensemble. So I feel like they really need to figure out a way to make the Guardians more present in Mark's story for me to invest in them as characters. To go back to what was his name? Connor?
Donald, yeah.
That's how much I pay attention to the show.
Yeah.
Donald, because I wanted to say my joke. They made him into Cliff from Doom Patrol. Done. So, anyway, so that was about Donald. And we talked about Mark becoming a single father to his half-alien brother. It's just... There's not really a lot that technically happened in this episode, because it is the mid-season return, and it's been so long since the fourth episode that they had to kind of explain, okay, so while Mark was here, he's going to come back to Earth and then see what went on with his mom while he was gone and what went on with his girlfriend, who I found to be really interesting, because there's resentment that's building.
Yeah.
And I'm waiting for that argument to happen and for that shoe to drop and for Mark to really start to understand Nolan's perspective as being not fully human. I don't think in the first season that it's ever fully dawned on him what that means. And just because you have powers, well, that's from a part of you that's from this other species. So So I think that they have a lot to explore. But at the same time, this release schedule has done no favors for this show.
No, it didn't. I agree with you that, in particular with Amber, because Mom, I still, she's got her story. I don't know her and Mark talking about the books and what she did with them. But Amber, yeah, you're right. I mean, that resentment is building. I mean, she's being supportive, but they're starting to see some cracks in the foundation there with their relationship as far as being supportive. And I think you hit the nail on the head as far as Mark really now in the second season is really starting to understand what his father went through. And especially after he saw from the consequences of it, not necessarily with Earth, but with another planet, with the Viltrumites, and what could happen to Earth if he doesn't follow in Nolan's footsteps as far as trying to protect these societies from the Viltrumites. Right. Mission of conquering everything. So those were some really good moments. And then I did like how they tied the first season story with Shapesmith and the whole Martian astronauts. Those are the things I think it also does well as far as building on previous episodes and reminds you of like there are. You know, there is an overall arc and things that happened in the previous seasons, does have impact on subsequent seasons. So I did like that aspect of the story this week as well. But again, when Mark and the Guardians do finally get together, it's just like you said, it doesn't seem organic. It just seems like very forced.
Yeah. Yeah, to go back to his mom, what I was saying was more, or what I saw was more about how she's, during the first half of this season, we saw a lot from her about essentially the grieving process of her husband, of the life that she once had. Mm-hmm. And now she's gone through 2 months without her son, who technically is the only tie left that she has to Nolan. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder if that allowed her some peace.
Yeah.
Just because you love your child, mm-hmm. but he is still a part of Nolan and still like tied to them in that way. So when, just because Nolan left doesn't mean that you're not shackled in some sort of way because you have a kid together. And now on top of it, she's presented with, oh, Nolan, like when he went away, he went and he got together with another woman. Yeah. And also reproduced. And so now you're also not only having to continue raising your own son, but also Nolan's half son. So I think that there is a very interesting angle to do with her character in mm-hmm. terms of her trying to figure out what this means, especially as she continues. I think she says something about this in the episode, like, cleaning up Nolan's mess, like constantly. So it's just. I think they teased a lot of stuff. They did. At the same time, I'm like, no. Don't do this to me.
They did tease a lot. They did tease. I'm glad you brought that up about Mark's mother, because I just felt like they did tease it. It was, as you rightly noted, it's first episode back after a break, so you don't want to get too deep into it. But they did set up sort of the thread for, you know, now that you have Nolan's child from another mother under your roof, and Mark's asking you to help take care of it and that kind of thing. It definitely does set up some interesting plot points that they can pursue. Hopefully, they'll pursue them well. like they did with her when she was, you know, with the support group. I felt that, like they did that was something that stood out for me in the first half of the second season. So.
Yep. All right. Well, that is a wrap on our discussion of Invincible Season 2, Episode 5.
Don't forget about Alan. Alan's back. I said, don't forget Alan's back.
I didn't forget. I was moving on to the next show because it sounded like we were ending.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Alan's back. All right. So that brings us to Shogun, Episode 5, Broken to the Fist. And the IMDb summary says Blackthorne and Mariko struggle to contain their secret that could get them both killed. Yabushige searches for the spy who has betrayed his intentions to Lord. Will, what did you think about this episode?
Oh, this episode, it's like, this was like, I can't say every week this is my favorite, but this one really was really good this week. I think it was just a very, very well-rounded story. Toranaga shows back up to deal to see what the consequences of what his son had wrought with the cannon attack. Blackthorne, the whole triangle, Blackthorne, Fuji, and Mariko, with the return of a certain person who you called it. You were right. He.
Bentaro
was not dead.
I can say
Yeah.
No, he's not dead. And I did say it. And then you questioned. You made me second guess myself.
I did. I was wrong. I was wrong. I will freely admit. I thought that he was a goner. And but they figured out he got some help from some Ronin and he's back. So
don't appreciate that we didn't. I feel like they took the easy way out of explaining how he's back. And I think it was easier to do that in the book, but visually from a television perspective, or even from a movie perspective, it seems a bit far-fetched.
Yeah, well, I guess was it 20 Ronin that however many Ronin that helped him out, but only it took him 20 days to return and only two of them survived or whatever. It was like, I guess it was a tell not show kind of situation with how he got back.
It definitely was. It just bothered me because, I mean, like I guess there was nothing planted in that episode where he quote unquote dies that would say, oh, he could survive because there are Ronin over there.
And I haven't read the book, and I want to say I was listening to one recap from somewhere. I don't know if it was Rogan and Steve Miller or another one where I think they switched that from the book, where I think in the book he actually did commit honorable suicide there after he fall off the invade. Well, he fought him off, and then before he could get captured, he killed himself. So I think this may have been a change. So if any folks out there who've read the book can correct this, please do so, because I haven't read it.
It yet. Is yeah. Because then a recap that I was listening to, Roka's recap, and his panelist is a book reader, and the way he talked about Bentaro and the events of this episode with Mariko, those still happen.
Okay.
So I don't think it was a change from the book. I think that it got confused because people were talking about cultural implications of what could potentially happen. And I think a lot of the book readers are doing a good job while also like holding back and letting people who have not read the books be surprised by the events of the series. But let's just be like, Will was surprised. I was not surprised because
you weren't. No, I was sitting in the airport when I was watching the episode, and then when it popped up and he was back, I was like, all right, I made a note to like give you your props. You got that one, and I was wrong. The thing too, whenever he did return, it just really, Mariko's face, whenever she found out, and you know, he's standing there, and just, you know, hats off to Anna Sawai, who's like playing the character, playing her, because the face acting in that moment was just on top. I mean, all the various emotions that I'm sure Mariko was feeling, just was on full display there, from, you know, especially given that where the showrunner on the official podcast of the show did confirm that you know, Blackthorne and Mariko did sleep together. So you got this, and now he's back, and all the thing, of course, then we learned that he's an abusive, but we knew he was an abusive spouse, but then we saw, you know, it play out in this episode very, very deeply and troubling. So yeah, hats off to her as far as the way she conveyed what the character was feeling at that moment.
So what do you make of the fact that we're given Mariko's backstory in this episode, and which has been hinted at in the mm-hmm. first four episodes and alluded to, and the shame that came to her family was because her father killed the emperor that preceded Teiko, and assassinated him. Not because he wanted the power, but because he knew that ruler at the time was very corrupt. So then, because of rituals, honor and respect and everything, everyone immediately went after her family to mm-hmm. kill them. Her father ended up committing suicide, and she... And this is where I'm like, can we get a little bit more context? Because she just so happens to end up marrying Buntaro before, I just want to understand the timeline. Yeah. So, because the way it keeps being explained, it sounds like he married her after the shame had happened. But that doesn't make sense to me. Of how she would be able to marry him after that all played out. So she ends up marrying him and therefore gets protection, essentially. And she wants to kill herself to die with her family. And every year on the anniversary of her father's death, asks to commit suicide, and he orders her to live. So considering the abuse we saw displayed from him, what do you make of him always making her live?
So that's a lot to unpack there. So as far as the shame that befell her house, I the only thing I could figure, just looking at the whole, learn to pick up the cues better than Blackthorne has, is, you know, she's Christian. So I'm trying to figure out, like, how, if that plays into the protection as far as with the, if that.
No.
Yeah, no, I was just trying to put the Portuguese. I'm trying to answer your, I'm thinking out loud, I will freely admit.
Okay.
Yeah.
We don't have to,
Yeah.
If nothing comes, man, I'm not even talking about her. I understand, based on everything we've learned so far about the culture at the time, of why she would want to die with them. That makes sense to me. I think she became Christian after that happened.
Yeah.
And which but still, that's her family, and that's her, that's what. Those are the rules she first learned about the way the world works. Mm-hmm. So just because she takes up Christianity, it's not going to like circumvent it. I mean, she's still asked to die. Yeah. But where I'm still trying to figure out motives and choices is with Buntaro and him, even though he's abusive and dismissive of Mariko, mm-hmm. they share the look.
Yeah.
when we think he's going to die, and a look of respect, and knowing that he orders her to live by all else. Like, it's interesting.
Yeah. So I do remember. Yeah. So the, yeah, you, what you said earlier, the, as far as the timeline, she had married him before the events happened.
Okay. Okay. It had to have been, because right. he wouldn't, that family wouldn't have like allowed that marriage to happen. So, had right. this murder occurred.
Exactly. So, and so and that's why on the anniversary of her death, whenever he, you know, she wants, you know, she wants to correct the injustice by, you know, joining the rest of the family. Right. Yeah, that makes, that's that. Yeah. So that's why it makes sense, because he doesn't, because she's his property and one. And,
but he doesn't.
Yeah. And
he, okay.
Go ahead. And it gets into the whole thing of the whole family honor and stuff. I mean, the honorable thing to do would be to die, but no, he's going to make her relive this dishonor every single year that whenever they have the anniversary of the tragedy. So that's his way of just like poking her each time. Like, no, you know, we're going to make you relive this dishonor every single year on the anniversary of it.
Interesting.
Yeah. Because, and it goes into that control and that abusive relation, you know, not only the cultural dynamics that were going on, but also just his, you know, clear abusive and dishonor and disrespect that he has towards her.
Well, I don't know. I don't know. I feel like, I'm not saying that there's love there. It's an act of love or anything, but I think it's a bit more complex, because from what I can tell, he's all about honor and respect.
Yeah.
So why would he want to and he, like, her shame is also his shame.
Well, but also, but she has value to Tornaga.
Yeah, but that just recently happened. I mean,
well, no, but
she's been married for years.
She's been married for years, but she's been trained to speak as an interpreter since she was a child. I mean, because remember the monk, the Portuguese priest taught her.
No, so, I understand that.
Yeah, so I mean, so she has some value beyond just, you know, to Tornaga, and why she continues to help Tornaga to show her usefulness to him, even though dishonor is still there.
Yeah. I feel like if we continue talking about this, it'll just like continue going in circles. So I'm going to try to move on.
But we did finally learn, like, as you noted, it was that we did, you know, it's been hinted on. And so we finally did learn a full story about what happened there, which also makes, you know, with speaking of honor and stuff, with Fiji and her family and learning of her father's dishonor too, with the swords, with his coward's death. And how she, you know, and especially when, you know, we see a similar parallel thing whenever her husband like stepped out of line and committed a ritual suicide, as well as, you know, taking their son. But then she, you know, now has to become the consort of the barbarian, but she continues to show her worth to the community and, you know, helping Blackthorn, you know, by being his consort and help, trying to help him learn the cultural ways and stuff, even though he still can't quite get it.
I don't feel like it's a value to the community. She's just becoming her own because she finds herself in this position tied to someone who doesn't want to pillow her, who respects her, who gave her a gun, and who she now is just, I feel like she loves this new life that she's walked into, and she wants to protect it. Like, it's not only she knows what the community thinks of him and of her as being so, but we find in this episode that she's really owning her place, and the place that just so happens, like, Blackthorn has a lot of trust in her. And so she's starting to become one of my favorite characters.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I mean, yeah, because yeah, and she, to your point about she really likes this station now, because you know, whenever Bentaro was like, you know, kept calling her a consort to a barbarian, she's like, no, I'm a consort to a Harimoto. Yes, so she definitely is. She's like, yeah, and that moment at the end of the episode too, I think, you know, it's helping Blackthorn. Whenever she and Blackthorn shared that look, I mean, I think it was, and her role as far as being the consort to Hadamoto and doing all the things that she's been doing, even to the place of concealing the affair, because she, you know, she's no dummy. She figured out what was going on whenever they had that conversation at the end of that last episode.
I don't know time-wise, like how long, and also the way her and Mariko talk, like I feel like Mariko would have came clean to her and trusted her with that information. But yeah, I appreciated that that line from her. Like the Fuji who we met in the first episode would have never had the guts to say that to Bentaro.
Right.
But now, since being around Mariko and Blackthorn, she does. So it's really interesting to see. And at the same time, there was conflict between her and Blackthorn in this episode because of the pheasant, where he, you know, he picks up a few words and he just so happens to be able to tell them that they may not take this dead pheasant down. It will rot, but in time it will be cooked and everything. And everyone's forbidden to touch it. Now, my first thought was Bentaro was so gonna take that down. but it wasn't. The community, the village got together and was like, this pheasant has to go. And it was the gardener who we see throughout this episode who has become good friends with Blackthorn, and he ends up in his old age saying, I'm willing to do it, and he takes it down. And then because of what Blackthorn says, Fuji ends up killing the gardener. And Blackthorn doesn't understand it at all. And I feel like between this story arc, between the arc with Mariko and Bentaro, and even confronting Taranaga at the end, and then having the earthquake, Blackthorn is really all of the stability he thought what he had here in the last episode just continues to be like rotated and shaken. And his comfort, he just finds himself, no, don't get cozy, you're still the outsider. you've been around us for like a little bit of time, that doesn't mean you are one of us. You have so much more to learn. Like things are this is still not where you're from. You don't understand our rituals and our behavior.
You're right. I mean, he's almost invited to the cookout, but not fully invited to the cookout. the whole dynamic there with Blackthorn, picking up a few things, but still with the broken broken Japanese, like, you know, touch, die. And I was, as soon as that happened, I was just like, I was worried who was going to be the person who would end up, losing their life over that. Cause I was like, this is not going to end well, with the pheasant. As you rightly said, I mean, it being the gardener being the one that ends up losing his life over it really does drive home the point of what you just said about him getting, don't get too comfortable, even though this, but also I think it also is helping Blackthorn come to realize that This place is slowly becoming my home too, and I've got to learn how to live in my new home. And especially as what we saw, I think he realizes that whenever we get to the end of the episode, after he saves Toranaga, with, you know, whenever they have the earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
And then taking his, you know, the irony of taking the you know, Fuji's father's swords, even though he was a coward, but, you know, doing that act because understanding the value of the samurai swords and handing them over to Toranaga, and Toranaga recognizing that, what Blackthorn was doing there. So I think that really illustrates that point as far as, like, he's getting there. He's getting there.
Yeah, definitely. What did you think about Lord Toranaga in this episode?
Oh, he, as you said last week, he is so missed, and and his presence does just elevate these episodes so much. I mean, from the very beginning, when he's drawing, you know, dressing down his son over the actions that he had undertaken. And also the interplay that he had with Yabushige. And again, knowing he's playing both sides, and Yabushige trying to, like, questions him about that it was his nephew who convinced his son to take that action and stuff, and just sort of the whole dynamics that played out there. It just shows that he's on one level and everybody else is just, like, trying to keep up with him.
So last week I threw out there that I think that Ami is the spy. Mm-hmm. And then you mentioned, no, there's a villager.
Right.
Who you think it is? So the villager at the end, was that who you think was?
Yeah, because that was one. Yeah, so I was one for one. I was wrong about Mataru, but I was right about the spy.
Yeah, that's what I kept thinking about. Like, at the end, when it's confirmed that villager, I'm like, wait a second, is that the person that Will was mentioning? Oh, now we're even on the prediction. Granted, I still, there's just something about where I don't think it's one spy. I really don't. But for all I know, it's just a through line to kind of drive in this whole dynamic of Omni, who wants to take over his uncle's position, his uncle playing both sides of this war between Toranaga and Ishido, and then Toranaga also knowing that he has this ally who can't be trusted but can still be manipulated, and that's the only reason why he's still alive. Mm-hmm. Like, that's why I find his character to be so interesting. It's just because he's everyone knows who he is. He's not a trustworthy person, which makes him honestly a trustworthy person when you're playing a political game, because you're like, at least it's very clear to me that I can't trust you, but I also know what you want. So in a way I can, because it's the people who I don't know what they want, I can't trust, or who I know want the same thing that I do, which that's Lord Ishibo. So it might take me to the very end of the season to just continue to say, please go back and watch the first episode. This character was not dumb in that first episode. So what the fuck happened? Because I, as much as I love him, I feel like we're getting a different character. And that inconsistency is kind of driving me a bit crazy, just because we're really supposed to see his nephew as being this bright person. who, because he managed to even like surprise Toranaga and be like, oh, well, he played my son, so now I'm going to give him the cannon regimen and reward him, because that's someone who I want as an ally who's like a trickster. But the nephew did not understand what was going on in the first episode, okay? I just can't get over that. Again, yeah. It'll probably take me until the very last episode.
You're right on point. I mean, because again, Toranaga was like, when Yabushige was like, I'll discipline him for like, you know, corrupt, you know, manipulating your son. Toranaga's like, no, don't. Right. He is like, he has given me cover.
Yeah.
So when Ishida like wants to start war and he thinks, you know, because you know, he's thinking tactically, because like if we go to Osaka, which I know we want us to talk about that and what's going on there, they'll take us out, but we're going to make them come to us because and you know, we got the tactical advantage now with these cannons and other things. So I thought that was, again, you know, everybody else is just, you know, dawdling around, you know, trying to get their little fiefdom. And he's just like, I'm going to get the whole empire.
Oh, but he's been that way. Lord Toranaga has been that way since day one. Like, and he's also, they continue to back up what other characters have said about him being a trickster. Mm-hmm. And he continues to do that. He has a whole speech about ravens and hawks and everything and prey and predators. And it's just, it's really interesting. He's definitely needed, just because everybody else is still figuring out what they're doing. they have their eye on a prize, but they don't really understand what you have to do to get there.
Yeah.
While Toranaga has not only already secured that, but moved on to a different game, which brings us to Osaka, which simultaneously we're getting some crossover to say, okay, while this is going on over here with Toranaga, Ishido is having to deal with the council is in a bit of a political disarray. And it's just, they're very calmly arguing, which is exactly what Toranaga predicts was going to happen. Was like, okay, I'll just remove myself.
Yeah.
But Ishido, just because I'm no longer there, don't think that your quote-unquote allies are suddenly going to let you pick a replacement or do things like so willingly. So what did you think about the council in this episode, Will?
The whole dynamic going on there, where they're, you know, sitting there going back and forth, you know, Ishido is not highborn, so whenever, you know, the Kayama was like, that sea will stink of countryside, and then and I was like, ooh, and then Ishido retorts with, that sea will stink of Christian. I mean, it was just like the infighting there. It was just, I was just chewing that scene up, because it was, I just love seeing, as predicted, and why Toranaga again was so smart to resign. They were just going to devour themselves and resort to infighting. And then, you know, Lady Oshibo is this, you know, returns and, yeah, you know, with the plan to, you know, she was the X factor there, because, you know, her son is just waiting to turn 16 so they could take over. And she's just like, you know, she's playing her cards now, as far as like,
with this
whole situation.
So I guess my question, I appreciate where they ended this episode with her basically telling Ishido, bend the knee, which Game of Thrones callback. Thank you. but I don't, I'm trying to understand, A, why she thinks she has a lot of power. I get it. She's the mother of the heir. I understand that. But this is, and I'm going to say this as a woman, this is a men's game. So, so Ishido,
that is fucked up.
I guess also where I'm confused is Ishido wanted her back at the palace in Osaka.
Right.
So what was his game plan for her return?
See, I don't think he saw her as a threat.
But and then my question is why? Because he seems a bit more tactical. He seems like a fair opponent for Torunaga. Maybe Torunaga has some edge, but there's something about where he was pulling the strings in the first episode where I'm like, he had to have some kind of reasoning for wanting her to return. And also, more importantly, Lord Torunaga not wanting her to return.
Yeah, and at this point, I don't know, to be honest. Yeah. I mean, I think that's intentional. I think they are trying to, like, and rightly so, what are the motivations here? Because, you know, it was clear when the Taiko died, the previous Taiko died, he drew up this will because he saw where these other regents were going to go. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if there's, you know, the lawyer in me was sort of like, okay, there must be some clause back there that he had tucked away in his will that Lady Yoshida is like using to now she's playing that hand. I mean, granted, everybody probably would be aware of that if whenever the regents saw the will where they set up the council. It's a very interesting game, but Ishido was like, the calculus I have right now is just, I know what I've got to deal with the Christians. I know what I got to deal with Torunaga, but now she's this new X factor that I wasn't anticipating. So I guess we'll see how that all plays out in the subsequent episodes.
Yeah, we will. I don't agree that he wasn't anticipating her because he wanted her back in the castle. Well, but the way they left the episode with their conversation leaves me wanting to see the next episode and just how that dynamic continues to play out in surprising ways. Because now we have, for us as a viewer, we're introduced to a brand new player.
Yeah.
Knowing that this player is familiar with the players that we have gotten to know over the last few episodes. Yeah.
One thought I did have while we were talking about it, given that you reminded me that he wanted her at the castle, mm-hmm. Torunaga wanted her away.
Yeah.
Part of it is that he wanted her and the son to be there so they could just have a convenient, convenient assassin take him out.
Right, which again is just why I'm like, Ishido, are you gonna let her talk like that way? Are you supposed to like kill her? What's going on here?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm curious about this, especially when I think about how one of his cards might have been what was somewhat speculated upon, that the heir isn't really the heir and is actually Torunaga's son. Mm-hmm. So.
Mm. We've been wondering about that. Yeah.
See, it goes back. I cannot pronounce their names. I apologize. I can, but I also just like, I get scared, but I remember things. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good callback with their conversation when the Taiko and Torunaga were talking about Ishido. That's a good callback. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that it is it for us tonight. Will, why don't you tell our listeners where they can find you?
Yes, you can find me on X, formerly known as Twitter, at Will M. Polk, WILLMPOLK.
And you can find me there too at SJ Belmont, SJBELMONT. Please follow our crew there. at Scene and Nerd. Friend us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram and Threads at @scene_n_nerd, and visit our website, www.sceneandnerdpodcast.com. But most importantly, rate, follow, and comment on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever your podcasts. Good night, geek out. You're welcome.